Hey everybody, it is Wednesday. I'm Tom Scott, here with RP Eddie. RP, for the first time, I feel like Corona headlines are creeping back in. Let me challenge that. For the first time in a while, they're creeping back in. I read some things that gave me a bit of concern. I'd love to talk about that. One of the reasons they haven't been so prominent is obviously because of the George Floyd incident and the aftermath, which I want to talk about that a little bit as well. We released part of our Neil Phillips film broadly yesterday, which we've never done before. I want to talk a little bit about that and the reaction to that. It ties to the conversation that we had with Neil last week. But to start, I think if we saw the headlines 2 weeks ago that we're seeing today on Corona, there'd be a lot of anxiety in the air. Now, it may be, well, my impression is there's just not as much. Now, that's just my impression. Now, number one, should I feel anxiety? And number two, do you agree with my impression?
If it bleeds, it leads. The capriciousness of the news cycle, clickbait media, all these reasons. I'm not blaming the media, but we move on to the story du jour, and it's not always the story of the week or the story of the month or the thing we should be paying attention to. And for sure, it's been the George Floyd protests. And within that, it's been a lot about the rioters and the looters and not the 1,000 or 10,000 times more protesters. But Corona has moved to page two, page three. It's starting to come back into the story today. And for unfortunate reasons. I was having a conversation today with some of my colleagues on our coronavirus task force. We call it the COVID-19 Intel Forum. And the conversation there was about, hey, is this thing something we need to keep tracking? And I was sort of shocked that we had that conversation. Of course we do. And I'll tell you why. One, we are seeing the disease spread more rapidly than it has in over 20 states in the United States. Let's put that in context. It doesn't mean that 20 states in the U.S. are going to end up like New York City, Seattle, or New Orleans. It means that 20 states in the United States are growing from maybe 1,000 dead, like here I am in Wisconsin, they've had about 1,000 dead. It's growing from 1,000 dead, and maybe by the end of September, they might have 1,500 dead or 2,000 dead. It's a doubling of the number. It's still a relatively small number. Now, I'd also note how hardened we're getting to these numbers. And let's understand what 2,000 dead means. If I said a terrorist attack just went on downtown Milwaukee and killed 2,000 people, that would be an immense news story. Now we're saying, 2,000 people will die from corona in this state by the end of 2-3 months from now, and that's not a huge story. We're getting very hardened to the numbers, partly because people are dying silently. They're dying in old folks' homes, and they're dying alone. And we talked about before, because the HIPAA violation rules, and because people can't go in and see their elderly relatives, and because people are locked down in quarantines and elder care facilities, we're not seeing those deaths. So 20 states in the union, the cases are growing. That's very newsworthy. Again, it won't be spikes like the cities. More to talk about on that. And you asked about it yesterday, and I have some other thoughts on that. So that's relevant. Next thing that's very relevant about the disease is it's growing around the world at an extraordinary rate. So yesterday was the highest number of new cases in the history of the disease, and today will be too, and so will tomorrow, and so will Friday. So the disease is going to continue to grow around the world. Latin America is in a really bad situation right now. For some extraordinary grace, Southeast Asia is not doing so poorly, but the emerging markets, is one definition of least developed countries or lesser developed countries, are really beginning to have a problem here. So that's reason number two why Corona is coming back. And reason number three is, as we recall from the 1918-1919 Spanish flu outbreak, when the fall hit 1919 into the winter, the disease came ripping back. And there was a 12-week period in that 2 years of global Spanish flu pandemic. There was a 12-week period towards the end of it when it killed more people than the entire previous 2 years combined. And so there's a lot of fear that this winter, this fall, the disease will come back strong. I could try to handicap the likelihood of that for you if you'd like, but I think it's certainly worth paying attention to. Why the fall? Well, people get into enclosed spaces. We know the disease carries much better in enclosed spaces without ventilation. We know that temperature matters, so the colder the better for the virus. We know that UV light slows down the virus. And we know that schools are opening up. And we know that people are getting back to school. So, excuse me, back to work. So will we see an increase in the virus? Yes, we will, for sure. Will we see spikes like we did in the cities I mentioned before? Let's hope not. And here's a final comment, just to sort of put together part of the puzzle. One thing that you've heard me talk a lot about is density of cities, right? So New York City went on fire and Milwaukee didn't. New York City or New Orleans, you know, was a huge problem, but Dubuque isn't. You know, why is that? They both had cases. And interestingly, Albany, Georgia has been a huge problem. 65,000 people live in Albany, Georgia, and it had one of the greatest growths in the country. Why was it there and not other places? Albany, Georgia is not particularly a dense city on a per mile basis. All the places that have had a real hard time, minus elder care facilities, but it's the same dynamic, have high density of people per household. So that turns out to be the missing puzzle here. We've talked about multi-generational households. We've talked about density. The real specific issue is the high density of people per household. You've heard me talk a lot about city blocks in the Bronx that have had more infection and more death than entire states in the union, like 20 states. High density of people per household ends up being one of the key variables there. So those are my quick thoughts on that.
So here's a headline for you that's interesting. And as you were speaking, I was speculating on what we're seeing. And it's 19 states see rising coronavirus cases, and Arizona is asking its hospitals to activate emergency plans. There's a lot of Arizona headlines. Do I conclude that that's because they're inside in the air conditioning and that's why it's growing?
It was 106 degrees in Arizona 2 weeks ago. Shouldn't that mean that the virus is on its heels? Yes, but if you're in 106 degrees, where are you? You're inside an air conditioner. You're in the same behavior as you would be in the winter. That's exactly why.
And that, it's just so hard to speculate or to know, and maybe you know something, I don't know, but sort of behaviorally, how are they treating those things? Can I talk about our dinner that you and I had? Are you okay with that?
I am now, yeah.
Okay. So RP and I had dinner together at a place in town, and it was for both of us the first time that we sort of got out in that way. We were outside, you had to wear masks, you know, entering and exiting, and the staff had on masks the whole time. But then during the meal, you took your masks off. And I don't know, RP, 2 or 3 days later, we get a call. Your waiter is sick. You should check it out. I wasn't so anxious. I don't know why. But you took a test and just walk through that scenario a little bit. Just react to it. Because I found it ironic that the first time I go out, I get a call from the restaurant and they say, you better get checked out.
Yeah. It was a little worse than that, right? Because it was, your server is sick, not positive, but your server is sick, and it appears to be symptoms of SARS-CoV-2, and your server for your Sunday dinner didn't tell us this until like Wednesday or Thursday, and we're telling you now on Thursday. So there's like, wow, like that's a mistake. And that server got tested on Thursday, and the results weren't going to be available until Monday. So you're talking 8-day lag from any certainty and a 5-day lag of notification. So we had a ton of tension in our house over at Tom. And the reason was, here we are in Wisconsin, and we had this long, and look at the kids in the background, right? We had this long-term plan to come out here on a trip to see these friends of ours who are appropriately taking this very, very seriously for lots of reasons. They have family members that have comorbidities and a number of other issues. And we didn't want to get exposed and then infect them. And they've worked so hard at not being exposed. And so, and this is all we wanted to do. This was, you know, months and months in quarantine. This was the light at the end of the tunnel. I have a dog over here saying hi to me. So that was the news for us, was holy Moses, this whole thing we planned for months could get derailed. It wasn't even so much our health we were concerned about. It was that topic. So it was really nerve-wracking. So Kelly and I, serious, real tension, like tears. Oh my God, what's going on? I don't know that I was nervous so much because I think we had very safe protocol. The server had masks on the whole time. I know that kitchen is clean, but we didn't. And I know that, you know, you and I have talked about the way we're protecting ourselves. So I knew that you were safe, a safe non-vector, but we, you know, the server had a mask on. So I wasn't really concerned, but remember we talked about this in our first conversation, right? Risk is consequence times likelihood. So the likelihood in my mind, my rough math was, you know, and oh, by the way, and we were outside, we were sitting on an outside terrace. So my likelihood calculation was, you know, let's say 25% likely she's infected. And then let's say 10% likely she infected us, or around 2.5%. So 2.5% likely we got infected was my likelihood calculus. My consequence calculus, as it needs to be with this disease, goes like this. Well, for my family, not so bad. I have some comorbidities. You know, I know what my number is. So let's say I'm a 4% potentially lethal. So 2.5 times 4, now we're down to the point zeros. But we're going to go see people, and it's not, I have absolutely no right to infect them. So I have to ensure I don't do that. So I can't take my calculus and ascribe it to them. They have to make their own decision. So I was like, shit, we have to tell them we had this exposure. What are we going to do? So Kelly and I raced into a quick clinic and we got tested, which was nerve wracking going into a clinic, right? Because that's where diseases are. And there were people walking in and out, everybody had masks and gloves on. And it was very, very well done. But we got the swab in the nose. It wasn't so bad. They had to do mine twice. Maybe I have a big nose. I don't know. And we were both negative. And it was a huge sigh of relief because now our summer can unfold. We can get in the car and here we are on a lake in Wisconsin. And we wouldn't have been able to do that if we had come back positive. And we couldn't, just to be clear, we couldn't have made the analysis without that test that it's okay to go expose other people. That would have been inappropriate and possibly actually even illegal, but amoral. So something to keep in mind on our calculus.
So something you and I haven't spoken about in a little bit, but we spoke about a lot in the past, my kids' camp. At the moment, their plan is to open. They're gonna open right around mid-June, I think the 17th, July the 17th. And they're going to run 1 3-week session. You can leave after 2 weeks, but otherwise you must stay for 3. You must get tested before. You must get tested after. You need a 7-day quarantine to go. So it's a test and a quarantine for 7 days. Then you go. And then I don't know if you get tested there or when you get back. I'm not sure. And then they have other sort of protocols for deliveries and things within the property itself. And then, you know, plans for contingencies if someone gets sick in any way.
Do you know how they're sequencing the quarantine and the testing?
I'm not sure about that. In fact, I think he even asked me to ask you a little bit about that. The state of Vermont is requiring a lot of this. He can bring, I might blow this, I'm gonna do my best here. I think he could bring up to 100 people based on this kind of facility that he has, but he's gonna cap it at 50. And I think he has more than 12 cabins. So you're talking about like 4 or 5 kids per cabin or something like that. He walked me through it all. Anyway, I find it hopeful and interesting. And, you know, I talked to him a lot about, he's a really good guy. And so I said to him, like, why do you want to do this? Because he will lose money, or he's going to lose money. You know, and he said, when I talk to all the parents, they all describe how much they value it as part of their children's growth and fun. And like, there were a variety of reasons. And he said, I just feel like that's why I make the camp. So, you know, can we do something that is safe and valuable at the same time? And so he's just decided that he wanted to take that on. Now, I mentioned the part about money because I think it's an important calculus. I mean, it's nothing wrong with wanting to make money, but if that were the motivator, you might wonder. And in this case, he will net less. He will be better off taking the summer off. Anyway, so what's your reaction? Like, how does that feel to you?
I think, you know, in my scenario, we've been in such a blessed situation. Three boys who can entertain each other. We have a nice lawn. This is during the 3 months of quarantine. Really good online schooling. You know, and we've talked to Stacy, for example, Stacy Woodland, showing us a lot of kids don't have online schooling. And that, so in that situation, those children, my boys, our boys, had education, socialization, and healthy outdoor time. But they still were getting stir crazy. And that's why we're here with another three kids, et cetera, right? So they're socializing. And if we didn't have that, then it would be a very appropriate thing for me as a parent to really try to get them that. You can come say hi if you want. It's really appropriate for us to come get that. And so, like, there's massive value in school, in camp, in socialization, education. Like, you know, we're not going to sit here and litigate why kids go to camp and school. Like, it's a very, very good thing. Remember, the mortality rates, the IFR, infectious fatality rate, which is the big denominator number of this disease, meaning if you get exposed, do you die, for younger people is quite low. Now, I say all these things always with big, huge, shining, like, asterisks, that we don't know. There's so much more about this disease we don't know than we do know. We're learning things about it all the time. Most of which are actually bad news. But right now, our best understanding is that children have a very low fatality rate from this disease. So as far as they're concerned, you're taking an extremely low risk. And you're really in the realm with the child alone of the flu. Children do die from the flu, and children do probably die from the flu they get at camp. Historically, I'm sure it's happened. So, you know, that's, you're running a risk that we've societally agreed to take. So that's okay on that instance. It's the reason you're testing when you leave camp. And it's what you do with the counselors at camp that are older, the parents that visit, sounds like there's none, nor there should there be, and what those children do when they re-enter a mixed society. So that camp is a petri dish. If they're going to be in enclosed spaces, which of course they are, there's a high likelihood that they're going to infect each other. That's what happens. If a child does show up that is infected, and they're taking steps to ensure it doesn't happen. So you must presume, Tom, that when your kids re-enter, that they are infected, right? And so you want to use testing on exit to see if they're infected or not. I would take your boy for a quick test as soon as they get back from camp, and I would try to isolate yourself from them in that process, which you can do. Get a test, and you'll know in 15 minutes if they have it or not. And if they do, then, you know, they need to quarantine for 14 days. And if they don't, you know, you took a risk, and they were healthy, and you'll be healthy, and you're not going to expose anybody else, and it was a good risk. So you can mitigate those risks on the front end and the back end. That's why I asked about the timing of the quarantine and the testing for the child. So it should be 7 days. I would suggest they should quarantine for 7 days, and then they should have a quick test before they go to camp. And on the way to camp, it should be they should be quarantined on the way to camp as well, so they don't get infected. And then you could nominally introduce 50 kids who are disease free. And if everyone follows that protocol, then you're in luck. And, you know, just remember, this disease, like most diseases, there's this concept of super spreaders, right? So, and this disease, it tends to really look like it's got a super spreader predilection, meaning one person infects 50, not 50 people infect one. So it tends to be a disease where more people, these super spreaders, are infecting large numbers of people. So that's the dinner party in Westport we know about. One person infected 38 people, I think, at one dinner party. There's a person in South Korea we learned about that I think infected 200 people. One of those people infected 200 people. So, you know, what would be fun to figure out is what makes one person a super spreader and others not. And I suspect it probably has to do with being a person who's a close talker and has a lot of spittle coming out of their mouth when they talk with other people. It's disgusting, but true. So I think it's great they're going to camp. And I think those steps are really smart.
Is it reasonable to, I'm unfamiliar with where things stand at the moment, and I want to talk about vaccines in a second as well, but just quickly on tests. You know, so I'm going to guess all these kids are going to be getting these tests around July the 10th. Readily available, readily affordable, readily reliable. Like, what will be the deal?
So the test that we got in Stanford, and this is worth understanding. So there's there's two measures of a test, and there's scientific names for them that are a little confusing, so we'll just describe them. One measure is the number of false negatives. Hey, RP, don't worry, you don't have SARS-CoV-2. You now can believe you're safe and go off and, you know, believe you're not infecting people. Oh no, the test has false negatives. It turns out the test that you, that I took, Tom, has a 10% chance of false negatives. That's a very, very dangerously high number. Now, we worked our way around that because Kelly and I both got tested. I got tested twice. So if you do that, you're minimizing that chance of being false negative. So one is quick tests tend to have a high false negative. The other one is false positives. False positives tend, from epidemiological basis, public health basis, to not be as bad news, right? Because people then protect themselves or others. So let's call it a, you know, by standards of most tests, a pretty shitty test, but good enough for where we are now, and the only thing available quickly. The longer tests that take 2 days have way, way lower number of false negatives, like down in the less than 1% number. So it depends what test you use. By July, we're not gonna have a dramatic change in testing availability. But the other thing to think about is, for example, I've had conversations with some professional sports teams and sports franchises, and they're thinking about getting their own testing facilities. You know, there, you know, it might be worth figuring out if there's a quick test that the nurse at camp could find and administer to everybody at camp that might be affordable.
And then, by the way, are they? I keep hearing different things here. Is the invasive cotton swab way up into the brain? Is that the method still? Is that what you did?
Not what we did. We did just in the inner part of the nose, not way up into the nasal cavity. And I don't know what's what.
Okay. So vaccines. The New York Times had a really nice graphic on vaccines. Seemed very straightforward. What it seemed to say to me is that there's lots of attempts, or seemingly, I don't know what a lot is, but in this case, it looked like there was about 20. One of them is in phase three, which feels good to me. maybe phase three is the long phase. I don't know.
It is a long phase. Well, let's do what? Sorry, go ahead.
No, go.
So let's just define success here. So you and I sit in our garage, we create a compound, we feel like this is good. That's drug discovery. We then go to phase one trials, which is testing the safety and the dosage. So we want to figure out, and that's a small number of people, and you do animal trials as well, and you figure out basically, is this poison? You're not looking for efficacy. Is it poison? And what dosage number does it become poison? What dosage number does it appear to be effective? Your initial tests where you're you're testing a small number of people. So you pass phase one, that's a very big deal. Then you get to phase two, which is a large scale efficacy. So that's hundreds of people, and you're testing to see if it works, right? So in phase one, you determine, you know, the Tom and RP garage compound, it takes, you know, 12 ounces for this thing. Oh, that's ridiculous. It takes 1 milligram for this to work per pound or something, or 1 milligram of the dose. Then we go to the phase two trials. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Phase two is expanded safety trials. So phase two, let's do it over. So we'll just take it from the top. There's three phases of the test, three phases of FDA drug approval trials. Most countries in the world use a very similar process. Phase one is drug safety and dosage. So is this drug a poison, or is this drug not? At what levels is it a poison? At what levels might it possibly be efficacious, have efficacy? And you're only using a very small group of people, like dozens, right? That's phase one. Phase two is expanded safety trials. So you're not really testing if it works, but you're testing on different populations. You're testing different races, different, you know, make sure you have men and women and children, a broader group of people to see if it's safe or not. That's phase two. You're in hundreds of people. So now you have a drug that presumably has some degree of efficacy. You're not totally positive and is safe, right? So at the end of phase two, you're like, this thing's safe at least. And there's enough reasons to think it's good. So to be clear, you've probably done animal trials before that. You obviously have some molecular basis to think the compound's a good one. There's enough information on efficacy. Phase one, it's safe. Phase two, it's safe at a broad group of people. You have a dosage kind of nailed down. Phase three, big test, right? So phase three is large scale efficacy trials. And this is thousands of people. And you're looking at people that, you're looking at all sorts of folks to test this drug to see if it's going to work or not. And now remember, you're not going to go to a multi-thousand person test until you know that it's safe. So we have over 125 vaccines in the world in development. It's actually like 160. There's seven in phase one, seven in phase two, and one in phase three. The US government has changed the process slightly. It's a lot of marketing and a little bit of reality to accelerate vaccines. They're calling it warp speed. You know, I don't know why they call it that, but it's called warp speed. And warp speed basically means that an EUA, an emergency use authorization, will be given for drugs that pass phase three trials rapidly. So an emergency use authorization, if they go through these processes, they say it looks safe, we understand the dosage, it looks like it works, there will be an approved process for the emergency use authorization, right? So then everyone wants to know, well, what's the one that's in the phase three trials? The other thing that the executive government did is it kind of picked, I think, five or six vaccine candidates that are most likely to succeed, and has given them special authorizations and extra funding. And the one that right now is gone through, it's in a combination of phase two and phase three at the same time, is a combination of AstraZeneca and Oxford University. And this vaccine is beginning phase two and three trials right now in England and Brazil. It's supported by this Warp Speed initiative in the US government. And there is the possibility that it could deliver, and these words really matter, emergency vaccines by October, right? Emergency vaccines by October. So 4 months from now, 5 months from now, you could have a very limited distribution of a vaccine that works for emergency use. So that could be, if it's therapeutic, someone who's dying of the disease, perhaps the vaccine could be therapeutic. I don't know if this one could be therapeutic or not. Or it could be for frontline health workers who need it, who are going to be exposed. I'd imagine you'd use it for very, very key government officials, for the Constitution, for the extension of constitutional government. You would give it to the President, the Vice President, the Speaker of the House, if it proves to be safe. Here's a final point just to keep in mind. We've talked about this from the beginning as well. The US government went through a kind of similar situation in the 70s with something called swine flu under President Gerald Ford, and we rushed out vaccines. So in our book, we talk about Cassandras, who are appropriate technically based warners who give a warning that proves to be true that are ignored. We also kind of look at the negative of people who give a warning that's listened to that's wrong. So the swine flu epidemic that never showed up in America in the 70s was a series of warnings about, here comes the swine flu, it's gonna be really deadly in America, we better hurry up and get a vaccine before the disease gets here. They rushed out a vaccine. The disease never really manifested as people had been warning it would, and the vaccine ended up being damaging and dangerous. Now, in this situation, the disease is clearly here, we clearly need a vaccine, we clearly need to accelerate in every way we can, but we cannot cut corners. My quick understanding of the warp speed process and other things that are underway here in the US government with private funders is that they're not cutting corners, but I would encourage everyone just to make sure we're paying attention to this. We do not want to cut corners on vaccines. And there's an obvious reason and not an obvious reason. The obvious reason is we don't want to put dangerous stuff into our bodies, obviously. Here's the non-obvious reason. Let's imagine we do. One big debate that's going on in America right now is about the efficacy of vaccines to start with. There is a very real voice of vaccine deniers, anti-science deniers, anti-fact-based science deniers who say vaccines don't work and are dangerous. Those people are putting children and humans at risk. Kids have died because of vaccine denial. Just imagine the ammunition they will have for their argument if the US government, this entire world, goes out and creates a vaccine that turns out to have some degree of danger to people. So that would be a long-term blowback that would cost us a lot too. So I do believe the current process is safe, but it's something that I think we have to pay a lot of attention to.
You know, I question their use of the term warp speed. I just think it's a no-win term. If things go wrong, you can just picture how that word will be abused in public hearings. Maybe I'm being nitpicky. I think the term warp speed is just asking for trouble. If something goes wrong, they're not going to leave it alone. But just a thought.
This is serious stuff. I don't know that we should use silly terms, you know?
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Remember, the president named it. He's I think, pretty clearly more interested in marketing and looking good than he, you know, whatever. It's a silly name.
So I want to just change topics to end. You know, the George Floyd story and reality over the last couple of weeks, which has been 2 weeks. I'm sorry. It all melts together for me. I'm sorry I'm bad on the time, but it's been a little bit. You know, I continue to believe that a piece of good news is the seeming diligence that people are using towards being solution oriented. And I would add there one other comment, which is that, you know, if you start to look at some numbers, that Trump number has shaken a little bit for the first time in a long time. You know, it's actually happening. I think Biden's just a little bit over 50% right now, which apparently Hillary Clinton never got to. And there's headlines about it. There's headlines about, you know, this Trump number, this Trump basement, those are my terms, seems to be lower perhaps, or less firm as perhaps it was in the past. Any comment on that? Just sort of the political...
Yeah, well, so the concrete change thing is really important. And we are, this movement, in my estimation, the George Floyd movement would have served itself well if it, you know, things would have probably progressed a little faster. I think we're kind of getting there. If there was, historically, movements like this do better, are more concrete, last longer when there's some charismatic leaders that people rally behind. And we've seen that historically from Rosa Parks to Mandela to, you know, Martin Luther King, et cetera, right? Gandhi. And this movement doesn't have one. I mean, even close to one, so far as I can tell. And so it's important to figure out what is the concrete change that the movement's asking for so that there could be response to it in a dialogue to some extent. One thing that's moving, gaining a lot of speed, that I think is probably very misunderstood and is going to be very divisive if it isn't explained a little better. That's evaluative judgment, but is defunding police. So we've seen a lot of activity around defunding police. I have spent a lot of years working very closely with the police department, different police departments. I was almost the deputy police chief of Los Angeles. I was asked to take the role and I didn't. I've worked very closely with NYPD and Chicago PD and lots of police departments. So I have a lot of thoughts on that. And just quickly on that, and we should talk about it more, we should ask, you know, some great police chiefs to come on and join us. I think what reason it can become divisive is the law and order voters who tend to be Trump voters. And that's one spectrum of voters. You have either law and order voters or civil justice voters. Like, what do you value more as one polling mechanism to understand different voters? Law and order voters, when they hear defund the police, I think they'll have an immune response and get very freaked out. Speaking of vaccines. And what's interesting about the defunding police movement is there's certain aspects of it I think a lot of us would agree with, which is it's not stop the police department and don't have someone show up at your home if there's a violent attacker. It's begin to put more social services into the society with some of the budget. And effectively, what it sounds like to me, some of it is like make policing more like British policing, where the police response isn't an armed response unless it needs to be specifically an armed response. It's an assist. It could be a social assist. It could be any number of things. And worth remembering, Tom, you know what COP stands for? COP? Do you remember?
No.
It's Citizen on Patrol. And if we get back to that concept of policing, citizen on patrol, you know, we designate you to have the job to patrol our streets as a fellow citizen with no particular rights, no special rights. In fact, you have a series of challenges others don't have. We'd like you to be the person we give money to do this for us. Like, if we get back to that concept, I think we would understand, we could maybe bring together different points of view on that concrete change. So that's one concrete change that's beginning to get a little more concrete. There's federal legislation around that concept. Obviously, it's a community by community issue, right? Every town has its own police force, every district, every state, right? So it has to be changed across thousands and thousands of jurisdictions. So that's one thing that's getting more concrete. The other thing that's getting more interesting to me is this idea of, again, we all have to be leaders. So I like the idea that it's in that same construct of reminding our police forces and our DAs and our mayors that they serve the populace, and having the populace reach back out at this instance in the CEO level and say, hey, I'm an employer in this town. Here's a series of questions I want you to answer me. I want you to be accountable to me. So a lot of that movement and the defund police movement, the aspects I like are about the accountability being increased for policing. So that's my first thought on concrete change. And the second thing on the election. It doesn't matter what the national polls say. You have to look at 8 battleground states to see what those polls say. And we're still so many months out, so much is going to change. Just think about the history we've had in the last 4 months. And you know, what's the history going to be in the next 4 months? You know, so we live in an era of the acceleration of history anyway. And we tend to, right now, we live in a half a year, in a year where history has been ripping. So who knows what happens in the next 4 months? There's a legitimate chance that one of these candidates dies. I mean, these are old men. There's a disease going around that kills old men. That's a pretty macabre thought, but I'm just saying as an example of the wild cards that are out there. So I don't really care about national polls. I really care about the polling in 8 different states. And then I care about looking at a number of different pollsters in those states. If you want to take an interesting exercise, if you really care about what's going to happen in this election, go to 270 to win, the number 270 to win. It's a website. I'm not affiliated with it. I'm not selling anything. And you can look at the electoral map. Obviously, remember, the last two presidents were not won by popular vote. They won by electoral college vote. And in fact, they both lost the popular vote. Trump lost by a lot. So the electoral math is what really matters. And go look at the electoral 270 to win. You can pick different states. You can look at the polling in each state. And I look at it once in a while. And I'll tell you, most current polling, it's still going to be a neck and neck race. Now, then you look at what's going on with all the protests. Will that mobilize a lot of the Democratic base, which is key to a Democratic victory? Young people, African-Americans, and others and minorities, if they mobilize to vote more, then the Democrats win. If they don't, the Democrats lose. So will these protests, will this large movement, the George Floyd movement, lead to more voters from those blocks? I think so. And part of what I see in the protests, a lot of the signs say vote. So when we talk about concrete change, defunding police is a big one. I love all of us being leaders and making sure that our governments at every level are more accountable to us, asking them questions and demanding answers. And voting, right? This is how we also can lead now, is to vote. So state by state, 270 to win, look at electoral math. There's 8 states that matter. It's obvious on the charts and you'll see them.
I'm going to outline a couple of reasons why our show is bad, because a lot of what you just said is anti-titillation, okay? And I'm going to give you some examples. So this notion of defunding the police is, on its surface, it is get rid of police. And then your reaction is, no way, or that's too liberal, or, right, there's just so many ways that you can interpret
it's
that.
It's a great clickbaity topic, right?
Right.
I guarantee you, Breitbart and Fox News are leading with, you know, some initial phrase that is getting to basically phrasing like black people. So they'll say social activists or something, you know, urging the end of police departments.
Right.
And the reason that they'll write it that way is so it's fear inducing.
Right. And so what RP just outlined was he would get beat up pretty bad in the media and the right wing media for what he said, which is that he wants to take a reasonable look at it. That's my interpretation of what I heard. And that's where I am. You know, for me, defunding the police means let's relook at the notion of policing in America. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds really good. And I don't expect someone to come forward with the exact right proposals tonight. But TV loves that. TV would love that right now, what you just said is really black and white. And it's already thought through. And it already is a version of communist or a version of whatever. Like, that's what it is.
Whatever it is, it's anti-law and order, right? Yeah. They're going to come for you. They're going to, the pitchforks and the marauding horde and the looters are going to be at your door soon.
So the reason it's bad TV is because
we're bad TV. Yeah.
Well, we are bad TV is that that's actually what people, that's not what people want in a TV show. They come, they don't have time. They want answers. They want to be on a side. They want it to be resolved right now. And they want to characterize the victory and the loss. You know, there's no way that, you know, pick your person. A-Rod is anything but the worst human ever. And therefore I'm going to root against him. And that's a good TV show. Well, no, it turns out the truth just isn't an interesting within the context of a TV show. There was another thing you said. The election. Because, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've certainly watched the last election and the number of times, I like Chris Matthews, but the number of times as a person, the number of times that Chris Matthews would come on his show and announce the demise of Donald Trump was nightly. It was just over and over. He's going to go to jail. He's going to get impeached. He's never going to get elected. The Billy Bush moment, the moments. Well, it turns out that wasn't true. It was inaccurate. I'm not saying he was lying. It was inaccurate that these moments were actually the demise of Trump. So I think TV right now, is this the demise of Trump? I doubt it. You know, what's going to happen is you're going to see different stories are going to be in the headlines in the fall, and they're going to be these dramatic kinds of stories, which is to say they're going to pull from reasonable thinking, right? So reasonable thinking, unfortunately, gets beat up in the middle of all of this. So why am I saying that? I mean, I'm saying it because, one, I think it's good for my own mental health, but two, I hope people think about it in those terms and recognize that so many of these issues are complex, they take time, and that the reality of what's going to determine an election, just as an example, is frankly just way off into the future. It doesn't mean it can't be impacted by parts of things we see today. Of course it could. But, you know, the minute the Billy Bush story started, and I just don't want to say the nasty terms, but I think you know what I mean by the Billy Bush incident. Man, was that made for TV. Like, man, was that a TV moment. You know, like a perfect television moment that turned out to have the result, did not have the result that the television seemed to say that it would. So just a thought, and I think this notion of defunding the police, and I'm doing this for me, and I'm doing this, I hope, for us. I mean us, yes, you and me, RP, but also more broadly, which is, I'm going to think about defund the police. I'm going to think about the things that maybe I hadn't thought about before, and I'm going to consider them and understand where I stand on them when I know more about it. Because it's an interesting thought. It's a powerful thought. I mean, what you just said, citizen on patrol, just try to imagine. I know it's hard to imagine, you know. I always say this, like, imagine if the schools went away tomorrow, what would happen? I'd end up calling my neighbor. At some point, I'd be like, hey, I got kids, you got kids. How are we going to solve this problem?
And you
interesting.
Yeah.
Say again?
And you would reform from the ground up something that would or wouldn't look like our education system.
That's right. That's right.
The do you remember in the 90s? I think it was the 90s. There was all this conversation about sound bites. It was like a cool term. What's a soundbite?
Right.
What's a soundbite? And then this is a president who's leading by soundbite. And it was a criticism, you know, that you were using like a one or two, less than a sentence to make a point. And I think Clinton was the president probably where you learned a lot about soundbites. And it was, again, criticized as not being deep enough thinking.
Right.
Now it's into clickbaits and tweets, 140 characters, right? So like, but previously we had nuanced, real conversation. Well, that's actually not true, but at times we had more nuanced, deeper conversations about what we ought to do as a society. And we do now live in a moment where we're doing policy by tweet, we're responding to tweets, not just the president. We're clearly past sound bites into 140 characters, we're clickbaity, and we're not able, there's financial incentives against nuance, it's clearly in the media. But there are societal incentives for nuance. There are, our lives are better if we think deeper. Our lives are better if we take the time to understand what these things mean and not just be like, black people want to stop the police department. That's you know, that's not the answer.
Dopamine.
Dopamine.
It's like dopamine really works in a negative way.
I'm having a lot of, you know, this is a fascinating topic for me because I have talked to for example, the LA City Council and explained to them why they have to increase the police budget. Now, this is maybe 10 years ago. And it's a different conversation, but my view then obviously had nothing to do with, so the cops could go choke people. It had to do with funding counterterrorism, which is a relatively expensive thing to fund. So it's a interesting juxtaposition for me to now be looking at this and say, I think the trope here will be, oh, we've overfunded police departments because of counterterrorism and because of post 9/11. We have not. They actually don't have a lot of money in general, but we have over militarized them. We've given them very serious military armaments. And I do believe that having armored personnel carriers, which there's like thousands of them in the police forces now of this country, sorry about that noise. You cannot simultaneously prepare for and prevent war. I don't know if I believe that. In fact, I think that the opposite's true, but I do believe you can't simultaneously train people to drive APCs and bust down doors and you know, be long-range snipers and to be de-escalatory community policing. I think it's very hard to do both of those. So I think we do have to find our center again.
You know, I think that story is well told, and I want to be clear, it's a dramatization. I've watched it's on Netflix. I think it's still on Netflix. The film about David Koresh. Wake up. Yeah. And it's really well done because they do a nice job of sort of outlining like who were these people, what were they doing right, what were they doing wrong, why did they need to be taken into custody, what methodology was used and what might not should have been used. But it sort of is the playing out of what you just described, RP, that a lot of people were killed in a situation which seemingly could have literally been maybe not even having committed a crime in the first place kind of thing. I mean, it's like that kind of story. Now, again, it's dramatized, but I think what you're describing is so real. I mean, which is to say that when you are approaching with battle position and all that armament, which by the way, we didn't see when we were younger, that didn't exist. Cops always looked like cops. You didn't see these guys with these big guns.
Six shooter in a funny hat, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, you wonder about what are the psychological ramifications of just that kind of a thing. And then I think the other thing is like, I'm going to go back and we can end this right after this, so I'll shut up. But am I my brother's keeper? Like, what is to lovingly approach someone, even in a situation which is potentially or actually violent? You know, it's not easy. This is not easy to imagine somebody in a confrontation. But to be your brother's keeper is a big deal. And I wonder how you might do it if that was the way you began the process instead of something just to consider within the process. Anyway.
A nuanced thought I want us to think about. Remember how earlier we were saying that we better not have a swine flu vaccine problem like we had in the 70s with President Ford, because it will add fuel to the anti-vax movement and that kills children? Like, if you make a policy mistake there, not only could you hurt people with a vaccine that's dangerous if you don't follow the process properly, you're adding fuel to a dangerous movement that could have much broader consequences. So that's called blowback or unintended consequences, right? So think about systems thinking or intelligence analysis, you call that blowback, right? Like, oh no, I didn't intend that second or third order consequence to come home to us. Waco, interesting you mentioned it. So yes, at Waco, dozens of people were killed, including children. That alone is a horror. And as you say, it probably could have been avoided, right? Wow, what a fuck up, pardon my French. Well, guess what? The blowback from that, the unintended consequence, the second and third order consequences of that were equally bad, if not worse. It led to a huge rise of white militia, anti-government movements in this country. As Ruby Ridge happened a similar time, that led to a lot of anti-government protests, a lot of anti-government militarization. So basically, all those knuckleheads you see standing in the Michigan Congress wearing their, you know, poorly fitted AR-15s and, you know, what did someone call them? Anyway, those guys who have to walk around with their guns now to show how much, you know, how macho they are. and to intimidate people. And I think it's a silly thing to do. I'm a gun owner. I shoot assault weapons. You know, I go to assault weapon shooting contests, right? But I don't think you should walk around with them and try to scare people. That whole movement largely came out of Waco and Ruby Ridge, right? As did the Oklahoma City bombing. Yeah, now that's a wacko going off and doing something crazy. But when you talk about blowback, second order and third order consequences, that's what you get to. So I think it's interesting and worth really thinking about. And by the way, that's all nuance, right? It's really easy to say, hey, we're at Waco, you're the on-scene commander, take your armored personnel carrier, knock down the wall, and get these assholes out of here. That's easy. Yeah. That's the easy move. That's not the nuanced move. And that ends, as I said, you know, we have now seen third order consequences of that movement.
The thing I want to comment on, compliment the movie on, is that the view is relatively balanced in the sense that, you know, you could so easily just mock and abuse the Waco commune members as nuts. And I think he goes out of his way not to do that. And then also, they certainly portray the military as pretty boneheaded. But the FBI is far more
balanced. Not the military, remember? It wasn't the military.
Oh, right. It was ATF. Was it ATF?
No, it was FBI HRT. Maybe ATF also. But it was the military. There's something called the hostage rescue team from FBI, and I've shot with these guys. Like, they're kick ass, but they're the people. Now remember, all this, it's very easy to sit here and criticize police. Like, right. If you're being held hostage in your house, you want to thank God for the FBI HRT, right? Because they can get you out safely. Like, now then, you know, they've been improving themselves over time. So that's the special unit of the FBI, the HRT. And the ATF probably has one now too. Everybody does. Every law enforcement agency has their, like, super squad. Remember, we grew up with SWAT. So it's like the permutations of SWAT.
So, RP, in February of this year, the end of February of this year, we were going to go back on the road and continue to shoot what's called Visible Man. We released a piece of that yesterday, so people sort of got a taste of what it is. We are going to go back on the road now. I mean, we stopped because of COVID, largely. I mean, there were other issues. We got busy at work. Neil got busy at work. But COVID would have stopped us anyway. We're going to go back on the road this summer now. We're going to look at this question more closely. Definitely altered in some way. I don't know exactly what way, and that's more about Neil than it is about, say, me or us, influenced by what happened recently, historically, with George Floyd, et cetera. So that's sort of what's ahead for us, and how is this work that we're doing, how does that interrelate with it? And we want to think about that too. But we want to continue this exploration, and it's an exploration of what you might have seen with Neil, whatever day that was we had Neil on. But the issue more broadly is the race issue in America and the sort of acute situation where we see today. Which, by the way, the situation today is acute, but that's not new. The acuteness might be new. The focus might be new, and the acuteness. New. It's the level of focus right now that I think is the most new. And my question is, what part can we play in keeping that focus high? And that's one of our goals.
I cannot wait to see it. I literally changed my life to get to have the conversation with Neil. Completely changed part of my view of this. And I think it might be one of our highest viewed episodes so far. If it's not, it should be. I am encouraging everyone I know. If someone's watching or listening to this episode and they haven't listened to Neil Phillips, they should. I think it's beautiful. He's such a special man. And it was a privilege to spend time with him. Thank you for doing that, Tom.